Welcome to a new edition of the Neon Jazz Interview Series with Boston-based jazz saxophonist and educator Tony Malaby. We had a long open talk about this COVID world and his creation that has been an outgrowth of this lockdown pandemic time. The new 2021 CD, Tony Malaby's Sabino, The Cave of Winds. On this project, instead of heading indoors, he went outside. Beginning of July of 2020, he began hosting regular sessions underneath a turnpike overpass near his home in New Jersey. He talks about this, his past, modern life, and the future. Enjoy.
Hey, thanks for taking a minute after Neon Jazz today. I appreciate it.
Sure.
So, Cave of Winds, talk to me a little bit about, you know, during this very strange time on planet Earth with, you know, live gigs opening up and things kind of wavering. How does it feel to actually have new material out during this particular time?
It's hard to, everything's off. It was a very confusing time. And also, right in the heat of that moment is when I start the process with Berklee. You know, I'm interviewing for a position as professor of saxophone, you know, a woodwind professor at the school, a full-time gig. And it was nerve-wracking and just dealing with a major lifestyle kind of change. But I feel all of that turbulence is part of that record. It's just a document of that. I was kind of reviewing, you know, I was teaching students, you know, just to try to break even and make some money, man. I was teaching all kinds of students, and I got students that were, I haven't had for a long time, that were dealing with kind of bebop language and dealing with, you know, specific types of chord changes and struggling with them. And it's amazing how fast I was able to spit up this old knowledge that I had. You know, well, try this, you know, do this. And then I would find myself playing with people and regurgitating this era from, you know, early 80s and this language. And wow, why didn't you stay with that? Why didn't you keep developing that? I started documenting it and using it for tunes when we were playing outside. It was exciting, but it was like, what are you going to do with this? Is it going to, you know, are you going to stay just, this is the only platform I had. I go and do these streaming things in Brooklyn and playing in these bars with cameras, you know, just cameras in front of you and nobody there. Yeah, really bizarre time.
And it's insanity, but I find something refreshing about the apex of kind of the originality of this notion of really capturing what's going on. I mean, you know, we're farther to the end, we're far enough along now to hopefully be in an ending point, but we're still in the vortex of this crazy uncertainty that wavers back and forth. And I think it's interesting that when we look back on this time, what you're doing and how this transpired and the reason that you just explained, I think that's going to be a massively vital document to kind of look back on not only this time, but how a jazz musician interpreted this.
Let's hope so. Everything just feels so off. I mean, I'm trying to hold on to the energy of that creativity that happened for me during that time, because it kept me buoyant in a way that I could connect with this gig at Berklee that is really key, and that I can say that I'm still trying to transfer all of the insanity and that energy and create art with it, you know. Yeah, I think trying to talk about the creative process, you know, it's like you end up sounding like an asshole in a way, or it's just always cliche and cheesy. I've gotten lucky a few times in trying to describe the things, but I'm still really in that spin and searching, you know, for a type of sound, entity that is still with me from playing down there. There was these textures that I was able to get in under that the turnpike where I could dissolve the sound and start notes in different ways and gurgle and throw the sound in really new ways. And I'm still working on developing that and turning that into language and turning that into compositions and kind of codifying that, you know, in a way, or cataloging it in a sense.
You know, I keep thinking about what you did under the Turnpike and visualizing you and the band and just everything that went into this. And I remember this year, 9/11, I was supposed to, there was a show that they were having shows outside, and it was kind of a gray day. I think it was rainy, and they went underground into a parking garage, and all of us are gathered around this stage, and this cat, this veteran guy, I can't remember his name, had a saxophone. He comes up on stage and blows that place apart. I felt like I was in a Mad Max film. Everything didn't seem real. It was like, we're in a pandemic, we're underground, there's this saxophone ricocheting off all this concrete, and I'm just waiting for the truckloads of people coming up with all of the costumes from that survived some extreme time that get ready to come in to usher us away. It was very strange. And I keep thinking about that now with all of this. Like you say, it's just off. You just, there's something that's just not right, and it's off. And to be an artist, to be able to capture that, to have the opportunity to have a historical document, I think is vital. I think it's, maybe we won't recognize it as much right now, but I think as time goes on, I think it's going to be huge.
Cool. Let's hope so.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's go back into your lineage here. How did all this begin for you? You know, jazz is a very specific niche, and how did you get the bug, and how did it become your life?
I went to a concert when I was 13 years old that was in the Tucson Community Center, and it was a band from Atlanta called Brick that had a small like R&B hit called Doozik, just a really different type of funk, you know. And then it was Average White Band, and then it was Tower of Power. So it was all, there was saxophone the whole night. And my band director, my junior high band director, knew what he was doing. And he took a handful of kids, and I was hooked. I was hooked and just started nerding out and finding out who the sax players in those bands were into. And, you know, they were into Train, and they were into, and just finding Dexter Gordon and finding that stuff. At the same time, I get a scholarship, and I'm studying classical saxophone with a professor at the University of Arizona who had gone through a real intense kind of grooming. You know, she came through this very important school of classical saxophone, and there was a pedagogue there named Larry Keel, you know, who Joe Henderson studied, and some of the Detroit cats, and a later teacher that came out of that school is a guy named Don Cinta, who is kind of a peer of my teachers, who went to Paris and studied with Marcel Mule, and this thing, and I mean, I started nerding out at a really young age, and really getting into the saxophone from these two perspectives. And I still play with that. I still play with that. I'm showing my Berkeley kids, like, you know, I learned how to phrase and how to, you know, top off air here. You know, you take a breath here, but then you just top a little more here, and then you can go this distance and make it sound musical, and it has kung fu. You know, the phrase doesn't die on you, and I just watch these kids learn this way, and then transfer it to how they play jazz. And just so, the physical aspects of that type of training, you know, I was really lucky to have. But it was seeing Tower of Power, seeing Lenny Pickett play the tenor like that, that just was hook, line, and sinker for me. It was like, man,
it's the gateway. Yeah. And you're in an interesting position. You know, you're a recording artist, you're a performer, but you're also a teacher. How are you helping these kids through this time? You know, obviously, I have teenagers myself, so I'm watching this and I'm thinking, I've been around longer. There's a level of dexterity that goes into longevity, you know, but these kids are just, you know, watching all of this unfold. How are you helping them through it?
Well, I'm a parent too. I have a 16-year-old, and I really am parenting in a lot of ways. I'm seeing them come out of, you know, the situation where they were locked up for so long, and trying to get them off of their devices and their ways of how they were dealing with music during the pandemic. Now they're in front of me. Let's play together. Let's listen to each other and play off of each other. Them playing with a metronome that's in the room and not in their ears via headphone or just this digital thing that's, I'm trying to connect them and slow them down into my OMAD frequency and how I deal with it, and show them that kind of yoga in a way. And trying to make them, you connect with some and you don't with others. I have kids that show up to their lessons half an hour early sometimes, and they know I'm on my lunch break, and a lot of the times I'm practicing, and I've learned to say, man, you got to give me another half hour. I'm onto something, you know, and they'll sit outside, and other times I'll let them in because they need that connection. They're starting to discover that again. And I want to let them know, hey, man, it's cool. We have to find each other that way. Make any sense?
I certainly do. Yeah, it does. I get it. I understand that, you know, not only having kids, but just navigating through this world. It's like there's got to be a level of us that have levels of empathy and compassion that are much different than what we had prior to March of 2020, because we are all going through the psychological ringer, so to speak. You moved from Arizona to New York. What kind of thrill was that for you to go into the cauldron of jazz and to kind of elevate your existence in music?
It completely felt right. It completely was meant to happen. Those early years are some of the happiest years of my life, and just finding like-minded energy in the cats. It felt like home. It felt like, wow, this is where I've always belonged. This is where I just connected in a way musically that I never experienced out west, with rhythm and with sound. It was unbelievable.
And then you elevate that to the cast that you played with. I mean, you have Charlie Hayden's outfit, Paul Motian, you have Tim Byrne, Chris Davis, you know, Mario Ehrlich, you have all these names. And I'm curious, as a teacher, what did you learn from these very esteemed jazz musicians that you in turn have used to teach your kids?
There's an energy there, like I said before. I mean, there's a work ethic. There's a craft and a discipline. I mean, Tim, you know, people like Mark Elias, Formanac, they're so prolific. They're always at it. They're always at it. And it's really important if you're going to do this and get off the way I want to get off to maintain that game, because I want to play that kind of basketball. Is with those kinds of people. I practice a lot at the school. I'm off practicing my own things, and just, I want them to learn about that. I have kids that have a hard time getting to 20 minutes or 30 minutes a day. They're dealing with a lot of what we were talking about earlier, just coming out of this thing, and all of a sudden you're in school and you can go to classes and you can... And I have other guys that are hitting it 4 to 5 hours a day, and just balancing that out as a teacher, I find that I have to be honest with them and just show them what I'm working on or how I'm dealing with it, you know, and how I would work on this passage and how I'm having, it's working out. It's working out. I had final exams last week and it really kicked my ass. The whole experience, I feel like I was blindsided in July when this whole process started. And I'm just catching my breath. I'm just getting my footing in a way. But it was exciting. And I feel like I can make a difference and present a different kind of story there that doesn't exist at the school. Hardly anybody knows my work. That's coming from the, you know, the more free improv world. Everything they know is because of Charlie Hayden, Palm Ocean, and just that dimension of my story. So it's really fun watching these kids discover that side of me. They came to a show where I played with Ben Bonner and a drummer from here, and it was incredible, just the reactions and the commentary afterwards. And that I'm their teacher, they're who I'm studying with at Berkeley. And what I teach them, you know, and they didn't hear any of that. But they hear the connection. In a sense. They hear what's behind it, you know.
Absolutely.
So yeah, it's good to be living and having that platform right now, because the whole thing with gigs and everything I was doing before is it's off. It's not happening. And this is a place where I'm maintaining my edge. You know, my story, where I come from, how I deal with it, and learning how to balance that with students. But Boston is tough, man. It's a dud. There's nothing happening here. I mean, there's a handful of guys, but the situations to play at are limited. It's a pay-to-play place. You have to rent spaces.
Wow.
You know, none of that makes any sense to me at all, coming from New York. And just my experiences with places like Chicago, playing shows in Mexico City, Chicago, Argentina, all of what I just... those cities that I just mentioned, they're like, none of that exists here. That energy from those places. I'm going to start to get organized and organize people, because I need to create this, I need to play with cats.
Yeah.
So now I've kind of been through a semester at the school. Now I'm going to start working on, you know, playing situations up here. And
I hear that a lot about Boston. And it's actually strange, as I've done this show over the years, Kansas City has kind of become a hotbed. I mean, it's a real destination and there's a lot going on. So
that's beautiful.
Yeah, it's a good thing for sure. So I got a couple more questions for you. The first one I have is, you know, if you have a dream tonight, you run into your younger self, and you can give your younger self, around the time that you were leaving for New York, starting out, you could give yourself one piece of advice based on the wisdom that you've gained over the years. And this isn't a regret question. It's you taking the wisdom and the years of experience. What would you tell your younger self?
Don't try so hard. It was all there. It was just, it unfolds by itself.
Yeah, I get it. Final question.
Yeah, I mean, that's a little abstract, but...
No,
I
get it, yeah. And I get it because I'm at that age. I get it. Now, other ages might not, but this is a question about somebody that's been around for a while. So everyone has a perception or an idea of who they think you are, your family, your friends, your fans, your students, but ultimately you have a perception of yourself. You live your life. Who do you think you are?
Kung Fu Panda.
I like it. Hey, Tony, thank you. But thank you for opening up. Good luck with everything. Hopefully,
all right, brother.
the earth gets back on its axis, because it's I get it. It's very strange.
Hey, I appreciate it. Thanks for the help, man.
Thanks for listening and tuning in to another Neon Jazz interview, where we give you a bit of insight into the finest players in Arizona, Boston, New York City, Kansas City, and spots all over the world giving fans all that jazz. Thanks to Tony for his time, cool, and class. If you want to hear more interviews, go to Famous Interviews with Joe Domino in the iTunes Store. Visit NeonJazz at YouTube.com, and for everything Neon Jazz all the time, go to the NeonJazz.blogspot.com. Until next time, enjoy the jazz, my friends.
Neon Jazz.